I should stop. According to the repugnant conclusion, compared with the existence of many people who'd all have some very high quality of life, there's some much larger number of people whose existence would be better, even though they would all have lives that were barely worth living. Now, that conclusion is implied by the utilitarian view that it would always be better if there was a greater total sum of happiness. There might be such a greater sum in the lives of many people who each had very little happiness, just as there might be some greater mass of milk in a vast heap of bottles that each contained only one drop. To avoid this conclusion, though, it's not enough to reject this utilitarian total view. On what I shall call the simple view, anyone's existence is in itself good and makes the world in one way better if this person's life is good to live or worth living. Someone's existence has more value on this view if this person's life is more worth living, but even if it's barely worth living or only slightly better than nothing, this person's existence has some intrinsic value, making the world slightly better. Well, those claims seem to imply that compared with a world in which everyone's quality of life would be very high, there would be other possible worlds whose enormous population would make them, even though everyone else's life were barely worth living, better. That's the repugnant conclusion. Several people have reluctantly accepted that conclusion. This conclusion seems repugnant, some of them claim, because we can't adequately imagine very large numbers. When we think of lives that are barely worth living, we fail to realize how much value there could be in billions of such lives. Well, there are some cases of this kind. Many people underestimate what natural selection could achieve during millions of years. But that's not why most of us would find the repugnant conclusion hard to accept. We would believe that compared with the existence of many people with very good lives, there's no number of other people whose existence would be better if their lives were barely worth living. Even if we can't adequately imagine very large numbers, we understand the belief that there's no number of such people whose existence would be better. Some other people reject the repugnant conclusion by denying that there's any intelligible impersonal sense in which some outcomes can be better or worse than others. But on this view, compared with a world in which everyone had very good lives, it would not be worse if everyone's life was full of suffering. And that's another repugnant conclusion. A third group of people claim that for someone's existence to be in itself good and to make the world better, it's not enough that this person's life is worth living or above the zero level of well-being. This person's quality of life must be above another, higher, critical level. These writers accept only a weaker form of the repugnant conclusion. On this view, compared with the existence of many people whose quality of life would be very high, there are some much larger numbers of people whose existence would be better, though their lives would be only just above the critical level. Now, that conclusion would be significantly less repugnant if these lives were, as John Broom supposes, reasonably good. This view takes two forms. When people's lives are worth living but not above the critical level, they're in what we can call the critical range. On the neutral critical view, when people's lives are in this range, their existence has no intrinsic value, so it wouldn't be worse if their lives were not reasonably good but were barely worth living. We might call this the callous conclusion. On the negative critical view, when people have lives that are worth living but below the critical level, their existence has disvalue. This view implies that if there existed enough people with lives that were close to being reasonably good, that would be worse than if there existed many fewer people whose lives would all be full of suffering and worse than nothing. Well, Gustav Arrhenius calls this the sadistic conclusion. That name is unfair, since those who accept this view would regret the existence of such wretched people, but I can't see how this view could be true. Some other writers suggest another way to avoid the repugnant conclusion, on what we can call the diminishing value views, though it would always be in itself better if there existed any extra person whose life would be worth living, the goodness of there being more such people would steadily diminish and would have some upper limit. Though such views are less implausible, they're open to strong objections. One is the fact that we can't defensibly make such claims about the existence of people whose lives would be full of suffering and worse than nothing. The existence of these people wouldn't have a badness that would diminish as the number of such people grew, so that it mattered less and less whether there were more such people. The badness of such suffering would never decline. Though there are some asymmetries between suffering and happiness, and some of the other things that can make lives good and bad, we can't, I believe, plausibly either apply some diminishing value view to lives that are bad, or restrict this view to lives that are good. There's another, better view. We can believe that as the simple view claims, anyone's existence is in itself good, if this person's life is worth living, and that goodness has no diminishing value, so that if there are more such people, the combined goodness of their existence would have no upper limit. But we can add, if many people exist who'd all have some high quality of life, that would be better than the non-existence of any number of people whose lives, though worth living, would be in certain ways much less good. Now, those claims together assert one kind of lexical superiority. When we say that things of kind P are lexically better than things of kind Q, we can mean that though the existence of more Qs would always be non-diminishingly better, the existence of enough Ps would be better than the existence of any number of Qs. Now, that view may seem implausibly extreme, since it claims that though such less good lives would have non-diminishing value, no amount of this value could be as great as the value of the much better lives. Critical level views make no such claim, but those other views are not lexical only because, rather than claiming that such less good lives have lexically inferior value, these views claim that such lives, though worth living, have either no value or disvalue, and those claims are more extreme. Lexical views are often claimed to be open to decisive objections. Before discussing these objections, I shall defend some claims about what we can call evaluative imprecision. That may seem a digression, but of the impressive arguments that many people have given for various repugnant conclusions, most assume precision. There can be fairly precise truths about the relative value of some things. One of two painful ordeals, for example, might be twice as bad as the other by involving pain of the same intensity for twice as long. But in most cases, relative value doesn't depend only on any such single measurable property. When two painful ordeals differ greatly in both their length and their intensity, there are no precise truths about whether and how, by how much, one of these ordeals would be worse. There's no scale on which we could weigh the relative importance of intensity and length. Nor could 5 minutes of ecstasy be precisely 7.6 times better than 10 hours of amusement. If we compare different careers, different ways in which our life might go, or we're deciding whether to have children, there are only imprecise truths about which of those possible lives would be better or worse. And there are only imprecise truths about many other acts and outcomes, such as ones that would greatly benefit a few people or give lesser benefits to others. Some of those can be better or worse, but never in a precise way. Well, such imprecision isn't the result of vagueness in our concepts or our lack of knowledge. It's part of what we would know if we knew the full facts. When two things are qualitatively very different, these differences would often make it impossible either that one of these things is better than the other by some precise amount, or that they're both precisely equally as good. Now, similar claims apply to many non-evaluative facts. There may be only imprecise truths about which of two scientific theories is simpler or explains more, or which of two rooms is more untidy, or which of two mountains is harder to climb. And when two people have different mental abilities, these people could not be precisely equally intelligent. There's one kind of case suggested by Ruth Chang in which it may be easiest to see that there couldn't be any precise truths about some relation between two things. We may start by assuming that given the great qualitative differences between two things, there couldn't be any such relational truth. Suppose I ask you whether Einstein or Bach was a greater genius or achieved more. You may first assume that this question couldn't have an answer, since it makes no sense to compare the genius or the achievements of scientists and composers. But I might then point out that Bach was clearly a greater genius than many bad scientists, and Einstein a greater genius than many bad composers. When you realize that there can be truths of this kind, you wouldn't suddenly come to believe that as geniuses or in their achievements, Einstein and Bach might be precisely equally as great. As you'd see, the truth could be only that one of these people was imprecisely greater than the other, or more plausibly, that they were imprecisely equally great. Now, many people assume that when there are truths about the relative goodness of different things, these truths must be precise, though we can't know what these truths are, perhaps. Now, there's one way in which this may seem to be the only possible view. If things of some kind can be better or worse than others, and by more or less, it may seem that the goodness of these things corresponds to their position on some line or scale of value. On this linear model, truths about goodness must be precise because positions are precise. Suppose, for example, that one of two things starts by being better than the other, but then smoothly deteriorates and ends up by being worse. If the value of these things corresponded to their position on some line, the better thing's value would start by being higher on the line, and then move down until it becomes lower. At some point during this process, the value of the two things must be precisely equal. But when two things are qualitatively very different, I've claimed, that couldn't be true. So when we think about the goodness of such things, we have to reject the linear model. Nor could differences in the goodness of these things correspond to different real numbers, since numbers are also precise. Nor should we claim that some things are better than others by some imprecise amount or to some imprecise degree, since the concepts of an amount or degree also imply precision. We should talk only of differences between the value of these things, since the concept of a difference doesn't imply precision. Now, one of two things is better than the other thing. That's often all we need to know, since it doesn't matter whether this difference in value is precise. But when neither of two things is better than the other, we may need to know whether this relation is precise. That may make a difference to which conclusions we ought to reach. Some relation R is transitive when, if X is R related to Y, and Y is R related to Z, X must be R related to Z. One example is taller than. If Tom is taller than Dick, who's taller than Harry, Tom must be taller than Harry. some relation is not transitive, even when if X is R related to Y, which is R related to Z, X may not be R related to Z. One example is the relation friend of. Even if Tom is a friend of Dick, who's a friend of Harry, Tom may not be a friend of Harry. Now, precisely equal is a transitive relation. If X is precisely equally as good as Y, which is precisely equally as good as Z, X must be precisely equally as good as Z. But if X and Y are imprecisely equal, so that neither is worse than the other, these imprecise relations are not precise. Even if X is not worse than Y, which is not worse than Z, X may be worse than Z. Such cases illustrate these imprecise relations. Two things are imprecisely equally as good if it's true that though neither thing is better than the other, there could be some third thing which was better or worse than one of them, though not better or worse than the other. Now, that's most often true when one of two things is qualitatively more similar to some third thing. Consider, for example, three ways in which your life might go. It might be true that your being a fairly successful writer would not be worse than your being a doctor, which would not be worse than your being a slightly more successful writer. But your being a fairly successful writer would be worse than your being a more successful writer. So not worse than wouldn't here be a transitive relation. These points have wide practical importance. It's often assumed that if one of two things is in one way better and in other ways not worse, the first thing must be better, all things considered, than the second thing. But that's not so. When there's imprecision, the relation not worse than doesn't imply at least as good as. So one of two things can be in one way better and in other ways not worse, without being better, all things considered. Now, if we reject those claims and believe that even when there's imprecision, not worse than must be transitive, we may still be thinking in terms of the Lydia model or assigning numbers. Like some other important truths, these truths about imprecision can be hard to understand, not because they're complicated, but because they're so simple. When some things are better than others by precise amounts, such differences are like the distances between positions on some line, and that's a simple idea. But when some things are better than others, but these differences are imprecise, the truth is even simpler. Such differences don't have the further feature that they're like distances on a line. They aren't like such differences because they're not precise. Now, return to the lexical view, which claims that if many people exist who all have some high quality of life, that would be better than if there existed any number of people whose lives, though worth living, would be in certain ways much less good. Many people either ignore or quickly dismiss such lexical views. Most of these people assume that something's goodness corresponds to its position on a line or to some real number, and on that assumption, lexicality makes no sense. If the existence of more lower goods had non-diminishing value, but the combined value of such things could never be as great as that of some higher goods, that would imply both that there are no limits either to how high on the scale of value this combined goodness could be, or how great the number would be that would represent this goodness, and that there are such limits, since this position must be lower and this number must be smaller than those which represent the value of these higher goods. And that's a contradiction. As that shows, we can't describe any lexical view by thinking in terms of position on a scale or using real numbers. But that doesn't refute such views. We're trying to reach true beliefs about which outcomes would be better or worse and about what we ought to do. And we shouldn't assume that such truths must be able to be represented by using scales or numbers. To save words, we can sometimes use scales or numbers, as I'm about to do, but we should take care not to be misled. Now, some other writers claim that though lexical views may make sense when applied to things in different categories, as in Cardinal Newman's claim that sin is infinitely worse than pain, lexical views can't be applied to actual or possible things that are in the same category and could together form some continuum, with each thing being only slightly different from its neighbours. We can't defensibly claim that everything above some point on such a continuum is lexically better than everything below this point, since there can't be such a great difference in the value of the similar things that are just above or just below this point. We couldn't, for example, claim that pains of some intensity are lexically worse than pains that are only slightly less intense. Well, this objection fails, I shall argue, when we consider some kinds of thing which, though they can be thought of as on a continuum, are only imprecisely comparable. When that's true, lexical views can appeal not to some single point in this continuum, but to various zones in which some things would be imprecisely equally as good as others, bounded by zones in which it would be indeterminate whether one or two things would be better, or these things would be imprecisely equally as good. In defending this imprecisionist lexical view, I should first discuss what we can call the continuum argument for the repugnant conclusion. This argument's main claim is that, compared with the existence of many people who'd all have lives that were equally worth living, there are some much larger numbers of people whose existence would be better, though they would all have lives that would be slightly less worth living. On this view, any slight loss in the quality of everyone's lives could be outweighed by a sufficient gain in the number of people who would exist and have lives worth living. Consider the simple worlds that are overly precisely shown in figure 1 on the handout. The width of these blocks shows the number of people who would exist, and their height shows the quality of these people's lives. And gaps in lives show that there should be much longer. Well, on the continuum argument, compared with world A, in which everyone's quality of life would be very high, it would be better if, in world B, there would exist instead many more people who'd all be slightly worse off. Compared with B, it would be similarly better if in C, there would be many more people who'd all be slightly worse off. That series continues all the way down to world Z, in which there'd exist a vast number of people with lives that are barely worth living. Well, since better than is a transitive relation, this argument implies that Z would be better than A, and that's the repugnant conclusion. Now, in considering this argument, we can first distinguish between the quality of people's lives and the quantity of well-being per person. These might diverge. The best things in your life might be of a higher quality than the best things in mine, and your life might go worse than mine only because you'd have many fewer of these best things. That would be most simply true if your life would be much shorter than mine. As this example shows, if we care greatly about the quality of life, being in this sense perfectionists, that wouldn't make us elitists who care most about the well-being of the best-off people. We can next distinguish three versions of the imagined world Z, in which some vast number of people would have lives that are barely worth living. In what we can call short-lived Z, our imagined people would live for only as long as some flowers bloom. If these imagined beings lived for only one happy day or one ecstatic hour, these lives couldn't be called barely worth living, but they'd be too brief to be good. When applied to this imagined world, the repugnant conclusion would, I believe, be significantly less repugnant. Some of the best things in life would still be there. Now, though the quality of life is quite different from the amount of well-being per person, I shan't discuss this difference further here. We should suppose that in my examples, people with lives of higher quality would also have more well-being. Suppose next that in roller coaster Z, everyone would live as long as in world A, and all of the good things in these people's lives would be just as good, but these people's lives would be barely worth living because their lives would also contain much that was very bad. What was good would only just outweigh what was bad. This version of Z also raises questions that I shan't discuss here. World Z, we can assume, would take a third, simpler form. In what I've earlier called drab Z, there'd be nothing in people's lives that would be bad, but very little that was good. The only good features I suggested might be muzak and potatoes. But that description is too simple. If the people in drab Z would be in other ways like us, we couldn't plausibly assume that these people's lives would contain nothing bad and very little that was good. Even if we lost most external goods, some of us would have inner mental resources with which we could make our lives fairly good, by composing long poems, for example, or thinking about some intellectual problem. Some political prisoners have lived fairly good lives while in solitary confinement. But some other people would find lives in such conditions worse than nothing. To make our questions clearer, we can suppose that lives in drab Z would be only barely worth living, not because they'd be lived by people like us who are in such deprived conditions, but because they'd be lived by beings who would be psychologically much simpler than us. Such versions of drab Z also help us to show the full implications of the continuum argument. Well, there's one continuum between human beings and their evolutionary predecessors, all the way back to some of the earliest sentient animals. When applied to this continuum, a claim like E would imply that compared with the existence of many human beings who'd lived the best lives that humans could live, it would be better if there existed instead some much larger numbers of the earliest sentient animals who had lives that were just worth living because they had enough slight pleasures like those of cows munching grass or lizards basking in the sun. And that's a repugnant conclusion. There's another continuum between the parts of our own lives. There are striking qualitative changes, some of which involve wholly new features, but such changes are gradual. Human babies slowly develop throughout their childhood until, as adults, they cease to develop and change only in other ways. We can imagine a series of possible human beings who differ from actual human beings by ceasing to develop at earlier stages. Another continuum argument assumes that, compared with the existence of many human beings who'd lived the best lives that were possible for them, it would be better if there existed instead some much larger number who would live the lives that were possible for human beings who ceased to develop, when they were slightly younger. So we have a long series. Well, when applied to this continuum, this argument implies that compared with the existence of many adult human beings who'd lived the best lives that adults could live, it would be better if there existed instead some much larger number of human beings who lived the best lives that were possible for those who ceased to develop when they were newly born babies. And that's another repugnant conclusion. A similar argument applies to any single life. This other argument assumes that compared with living for some number of years, it would be better for each of us to live much longer, though with a slightly lower quality of life. When applied to many such comparisons, this argument implies that, compared with living one of the best lives that adults could live, it would be better for each of us to live a very much longer life with only the pleasures of a never-developing baby. Well, we ought, I believe, to reject this single-life version of the repugnant conclusion. The best lives that adults could live are lexically better than any life, however long, with only the pleasures of a baby. Well, if we assume precision, it would be hard to reject these arguments. When we consider the many lives version, we'd have to claim that compared with the existence of some human beings who'd lived the best lives that they could live, there'd be no greater number of human beings whose existence could be better if these other humans would cease to develop when they were slightly younger. And that claim is hard to believe. But we shouldn't assume precision. We should claim that of the worlds in this imagined continuum, many would be imprecisely equally as good. We might, for example, claim, we might admit, the best lives that could be lived by adults wouldn't be lexically better than the best lives of those who ceased to develop at the age of 12, and those wouldn't be lexically better than the best lives of those who ceased to develop at the age of 11, and so on down to the best lives of those who ceased to develop at the age of 3 or 2 or 1. Well, when there's imprecision, not better than isn't transitive. That's how even if you're being a writer wouldn't be better than you're being a doctor, which wouldn't be better than you're being a slightly less successful writer, your being a writer would be better than you're being a slightly less successful writer. So even if my last claim is true, we could claim that the best lives that could be lived by adults would be lexically better than the best lives that could be lived by those who ceased to develop when they were babies or young children. Let me add, the general assumption is a lexical view, you have to have things in quite different categories. What imprecision does is to create an alternative, a long zone of imprecision, imprecisely equally as good. And then when you do get claims about what's better or worse, they're significantly different things which you're considering. Well, similar claims apply to other continuum arguments. These arguments assume that any slight loss in the quality of people's lives could be outweighed by a sufficient gain in the numbers of people who exist and have these lives. As we can more briefly say, any slight loss of quality could be outweighed by a sufficient gain in quantity. If we assume precision, it would be hard to reject those arguments. We'd have to claim that any slight loss of quality would outweigh any gain in quantity. As several writers claim, that would be very implausible. Compared with the existence of some number of people, it wouldn't always be worse if instead there existed many more people who'd have a slightly lower quality of life. But we should deny that such truths would be precise. We should then claim that no slight less in quality would either be outweighed by or outweigh any such gain in quantity. It wouldn't be better if there existed many more people whose quality of life would all be lower, since two such worlds would at most be imprecisely equally as good. Though the larger of those worlds wouldn't be worse, that relation isn't transitive, so we can claim that it would be worse if in other, larger worlds, everyone's quality of life would be much lower. Now, an argument fails if this argument has some premise, whose rejection is less implausible than this argument's conclusion. These continuum arguments assume that, compared with the existence of many people who'd all have some quality of life, there's some much larger number whose existence would be better, though these people's quality of life would all be slightly lower. As I've said, we could reject that premise by claiming that such larger worlds would not be better, but would be at most imprecisely equally as good. Now, that may seem implausible, but this argument's conclusion is that, compared with the existence of many people whose quality of life would be high, there are some vast numbers whose existence would be better, though these people's quality of life would be much lower, since their lives would be barely worth living. And my suggested way of rejecting the argument's premise, appealing to imprecision and imprecise equality, may seem implausible, but it's clearly less implausible, I believe, than this repugnant conclusion. And if that's so, the argument fails. We can next note that if this argument's premise seems plausible, and more plausible than my reply, that's because the argument at each stage asks us to consider only one of the many small steps that would take us all the way down to the repugnant conclusion. This argument is in this way like many other arguments with unacceptable conclusions. There are many acts, for example, each of whose effects considered on their own may seem too slight to make such acts wrong, though these acts would together make things go much worse. That's how we and others are together overheating the atmosphere and destroying or polluting much of the natural world. We should suspect arguments that would lead us to ignore the combined effects of very many small differences, saying that can't make enough difference. There are, however, other arguments for the repugnant conclusion. Consider next the possible worlds that are too precisely shown in Figure 2. In world A, there would exist n people whose quality of life we can call 100. In world alpha, there would exist n people at the much higher level of 200, and there would also exist a million times as many other people whose lives would all be at level 1. In the third world, Y, there would exist as many people as in alpha who would all be at level 2. Someone might argue, since alpha would contain n people whose quality of life would be much higher than that of all the n people in A, and the other people in alpha would all have lives worth living, alpha would be better than A. Second, since Y would contain the same number of people as alpha, and these people would together have a much greater and more equally distributed sum of well-being, Y would be better than alpha. Therefore, Y would be better than A. Compared with n people at level 100, it would be better if instead there existed some much larger numbers who would all be at level 2. We can call this the up-down argument. This argument's premises don't assume that it would be in any way better if there existed more people who would have lives worth living. And that makes this argument harder to answer. These imagined worlds differ in three other ways. If we could create these worlds, we could get from A through alpha to Y by raising the quality of N people's lives, adding many extra people whose lives would be worth living, and then redistributing to produce a greater and more equal sum of well-being. we can make the world better, this argument claims, by raising, adding, and redistributing. Well, this argument is valid. If world Y would be better than alpha, which would be better than A, Y must be better than A. We ought, I believe, to accept that as premise O claims, alpha would be better than A. Alpha may be in one way worse by involving inequality between different people. But the badness of this inequality would be outweighed by the fact that N people in alpha would have a much higher quality of life than anyone in A, and everyone else in alpha would have lives worth living. It would have been worse, we should agree, if some of these people in alpha had been much worse off in A, and everyone else in alpha had never existed. Well, it may seem that we should also accept the second premise, P. We may assume that it would always be better if the same number of people would together have a greater and more equally distributed sum of well-being. I believe, however, that we can defensively deny that Y would be better than alpha. Some people in alpha would have a much higher quality of life than anyone in Y, since this quality would be at level 200 rather than level 2. This higher quality of life, we should assume, wouldn't be merely a difference in the amount of well-being per person. At level 200, the best things in life would be very good, and lives at level 2 in world Y would not include any of these good things. There'd be no art or science, no deep loves or friendships, no other achievements such as bringing up our children well, and no morally good people. World Y would be much worse than alpha in what we can call qualitative or perfectionist terms. In one version of this case, lives at level 1 and 2 would be like the lives of never-developing 1-year-old and 2-year-old children. This great qualitative loss would, I believe, make Y in itself a worse world than alpha, even though Y would give to the same number of people a greater and more equally distributed sum of well-being. Suppose instead that in alpha some people would be at level 200 and many others at level 1, not because of such differences in the nature of these people, but because of a great and unjustified inequality in the distribution of resources. If that were true, and we had the power to bring about either of these worlds, it may be true that we ought morally to bring about Y rather than alpha. But we might believe that we ought to bring about Y, even though Y would be in itself worse than alpha. If we are not act consequentialists, we believe that in some cases we ought to do what would make things go worse. On this view, if we had to choose between only A and alpha, we ought to choose alpha, the best world. If we had to choose between only alpha and Y, we ought to choose Y. But if we could produce any of these three worlds, we ought to choose A. If most of the many people in Y had never existed, that would have involved no injustice. Since everyone who existed in A would have a much higher quality of life than everyone in Y, Y would be a worse world than A. With these claims, I believe, we can answer this up-down argument for the repugnant conclusion. There is, however, a third answer which combines the arguments that I've been considering. Nearly finished. Consider the first three worlds shown in figure 3. In world A, as before, there'd exist n people at level 100. In raised A, there'd exist n people at level 101 and a million times as many other people at level 95. in world B that exists the same number of people as in raised A could all be at level 99. Now, someone might argue, since N of the people in raised A would have a higher quality of life than all of the N people in A, and everyone else in raised A would have a higher would have a quality of life that was not much lower, raised A would be better than A. Since B would contain as many people as raised A, and these people would together have a greater and more equally distributed sum of well-being, B would be better than raised A. Therefore, B would be better than A. Compared with the existence of N people at level 100, it would be better if there existed instead a million people, all at level 90 times. A million times as many people, I should have said, all at level 99. Well, what that does is it makes the perfectionist differences as small as possible. The conclusion here is one instance of the wider claim that compared with the existence of many people who'd all have some quality of life, there are some much larger numbers of people whose existence would be better, though these people's quality of life would all be slightly lower. If we accept that assumption, we can apply it to a long sequence of other possible worlds. Compared with the existence of many people at 99, it would be better if there were many more at 98, similarly better if there were many more at 97, and so on all the way down to another version of Z. Z would be the best of all these worlds, that premise implies, though everyone's life would be barely worth living. Now, the continuum argument, I argued, fails because the rejection of that premise, compared with the existence of many, there are some much larger numbers whose existence would be better, though they're slightly worse off. I said the rejection of that premise is less implausible than the repugnant conclusion. We can't answer this third argument in this way. Rather than merely assuming that premise E, this argument defends T and the wider E by appealing to premises R and S. And that makes this argument harder to answer. To answer the argument, we must claim that we could defensibly reject either R or S. Well, we couldn't defensibly reject R. Since N of the people in raised A would have a higher quality of life than all of the people in A, and everyone else in raised A would have a quality of life that isn't much lower, we couldn't defensibly deny that raised A would be better than A. We might, however, reject premise S. Though world B would be better than raised A in utilitarian and egalitarian terms, B would be worse in qualitative terms, since the best things in people's lives would be worse in B. So we might claim that, this is you, given the conflict between these values, utility and equality on the one side, perfectionist on the other, given that conflict, these worlds are only imprecisely comparable and would be only imprecisely equally as good. Now that claim wouldn't be in itself plausible. There's a contrast here with my suggested answer to the up-down argument. In denying that Y would be better than Alpha, we could appeal to the fact that Y would be qualitatively much worse. Since the change from alpha to y, the best lives would fall from level 200 all the way down to level 2. There'd be no such great qualitative loss in a change from raised A to B, since the best lives would fall only from level 101 to level 99. Since this qualitative loss would be so slight, we may doubt that it could offset the greater rise in the quality of many other people's lives, thereby making world B not better than raised A, but only imprecisely equally as good. The important question, however, isn't whether claim U is in itself plausible. In deciding whether we could defensibly make this claim, we should consider how U is related to some other claims. Suppose we believe that as premise R claims, B would be better than raised A. Suppose next that we also believe that as premise S claims, raised A would be better than A. We then have to admit that B would be better than A. Be better if there existed many more people who would all be slightly worse off. This argument could then be reapplied to other larger worlds with lower qualities of life, carrying us all the way down to the repugnant conclusion. An argument fails, as I've said, if this argument has some premise whose rejection is less implausible than the argument's conclusion. We could reject this argument's premise S by claiming U. Though U isn't in itself plausible, we may doubt there'd be so much imprecision. Our main question should be whether this way of rejecting premise S is less implausible than the repugnant conclusion. And the answer, I believe, is yes. U seems implausible because in a change from raised A to B, there'd be only a slight qualitative loss. The best lives would fall only from level 101 to 99. It may be hard to believe that this slight qualitative loss could make raised A not better than B, but only imprecisely equally as good. But it would be much harder to believe that compared with the existence of many people whose quality of life would be very high, it would be better if there existed instead some vast number whose lives were barely worth living. Since U's way of rejecting premise S is less implausible than that repugnant conclusion, this argument, I believe, fails. By appealing to this imprecisionist lexical view, we can justifiably reject that repugnant conclusion. We can justifiably make other, wider claims. We can believe that compared with the existence of many people whose quality of life would be high, it would be worse if there existed instead many more people whose lives would be well worth living, but whose quality would be much less good.